Hello and welcome to Viva Pod Vegas.
Oh, thank you very much.
This is episode 4, King Creole from 1958. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. Mike, I have a question for you. Who is King Creole? It's the club. Is Elvis King Creole?
No.
Is the club owner King Creole?
Maybe by the end, Elvis becomes King Creole, but I feel like...
Because in the song King Creole, he's singing about a person, but in the movie, it's the club.
But it's not the club owner, the 40-year-old man, which really, who has designs on his 20-year-old sister. But no, I don't think we ever meet him. I think maybe he's a New Orleans legend.
You know what a 40-year-old man should say to a 20-year-old girl, right?
What?
That he's 38.
Oh, yeah. So bad.
Apparently, anyway. That's a thing. Okay, so now, we'll like, before we go any further, please let the listeners know.
Oh, yeah.
What is King Creole all about?
Jumping right in there.
Yes,
so
please.
Elvis,
plot summary.
Okay. Takes place in New Orleans. Like we mentioned, Elvis is a second-year senior, mm-hmm. from what I can recall, in high school. 19 years old. And how old did you say he was in this movie?
23.
Playing a 19-year-old, so not that bad.
Not that bad.
On the very last day of school, when he's finally going to graduate, he gets there late because of problems with his before-school job, because his family's pretty poor. His dad gave up and his mom passed away. He doesn't graduate, so he has to think of other things to do, so he joins a gang, which is pretty great. The gang of the guy whose brother he beat up. We'll get there.
The gang led by Vic Morrow.
Yeah, that's right. I like that a lot. He has a job as a busboy at this nightclub run by Maxie, who's played by Walter Matthau, who's just a real mean son of a bitch, who like has his hands in everything. He leaves that place and starts singing at the King Creole, like we mentioned, the only place that Maxie doesn't have any kind of connections to. His dad gets a job at the pharmacy, but he's really mad because his dad's like this pushover who can't stand up for himself. His sister falls in love with the owner of the King Creole, and that goes pretty well. Okay, so what ends up a lot is going on here, but what ends up happening is Elvis is set up to rob his own father to blackmail him in order to leave the King Creole and go play at one of Maxie's joints and like sort of work for him now. And Elvis just like can't stand for that, so it erupts. It like turns into like a really dark noir sort of halfway through, and like especially at the end when Elvis gets into like knife fights and fights for his freedom, for his family, and to sing. And eventually at the end, Walter Matthau is killed, and everyone's safe from his criminal grip, and Elvis is free to sing wherever he wants, so he goes to the King Creole and becomes the headliner, and presumably everybody's cool for a while, and they live happily ever after.
So I'm going to say right here that I think the first, like, two-thirds of this movie are, like, perfect.
Nice.
And then I think once the movie's like, oh, right, we need to tell a story, it slows down a little bit. This is kind of widely regarded as Elvis's best movie, which I can, we're four in. I mean, I think this is head and shoulders above everything that we've seen so far. Directed by Michael Curtiz, is that how you pronounce it? Curtiz, the guy who directed Casablanca. It is the third and final black and white Elvis movie.
Okay, good.
This is also Elvis's longest movie. It's like an hour 55.
Okay, good.
So we are basically not breaking new ground here, but we are ending old ground here, essentially.
Yeah, transitioning.
Here's what we do before we talk about the movie. There's only one tagline for this, okay?
Oh my God, that's rare.
It probes, and I don't know, Mike.
Okay.
It probes with the heartbeat of today's youth.
Oh, man, what does
that even
mean?
That has nothing to do with anything.
Probes the heartbeat.
Probes
with
the heart.
Probes with the heartbeat of today. You know, it's kind of funny because for a while I was thinking as he was singing, like, I was looking at the crowd, I was like, this is not the crowd to this music. Like, where are all the teens? Where are the kids? Like, that is a strange tagline.
And there are teens around, and I will get to the behind-the-scenes making of, but people were, like, all up in Elvis, of course, in his business. For a movie that is so specifically New Orleans and music and jazz and whatever, it probes with the heartbeat of today's youth.
I still can't.
It's not about
really
this movie. I don't know what it means. Does that help sell anything?
I don't think so. I mean, all of it... I mean, maybe that just refers to Elvis. Like, he's the heartbeat of today's youth, and this movie is probed by him throughout. There are some moments where he is like super creepy Elvis in this, and he's trying to probe other things, but that's all I could really get to is like, no, it has nothing to do with the content, any of that kind of, maybe some of the songs, but I think it's just like, hey, Elvis is in this movie. That's what the tagline might be trying to say.
Like, a new movie with Elvis. Want to see it? So there are 11 songs in this movie.
We'll
get to them when we go through the plot.
Only one song not sang by Elvis.
By 49a, the stripper.
The banana song.
Who drove people to the Gold Rush. Or they found her in San Francisco before the Gold Rush or caused the Gold Rush or whatever.
So did you get heavy King Kong vibes from that performance? Like, the guy drumming behind her in shadow was doing it like a big ape sort of, and she was, you know, talking about being peeled like a banana and all that stuff.
She has literal bananas on her outfit, which is amazing.
Yeah, which is just, you know, phallic symbolism all over the place.
So here are the 11 songs. We'll go through it again, plus the banana song. So there's Crawfish,
mm-hmm.
Steadfast, Loyal, and True, mm-hmm. Lover Doll, Trouble, then the aforementioned banana, Dixieland Rock,
mm-hmm.
Young Dreams, New Orleans, Hard-Headed Woman, the titular King Creole, Don't Ask Me Why, and As Long As I Have You.
Yeah.
So.
It's a full album.
Yeah. I think that there's a King Creole album. I think there's either 12 or 13 songs. Like, it's either in the other movies that we've done so far, there have been albums for that, or maybe they're made after the fact, or whatever. Like,
or there's songs appear on albums.
It's either, like, they're from different places, or there's an album for the movie, but there's songs that weren't in the movie. But this is, like, this might be the start of, like, hey, there's going to be a dozen songs, an album worth of songs in the movie, get them all in one place.
Yeah, it's, like, it's kind of cool. It's kind of like this exclusive thing where it's like, you can go to the record store and get an Elvis record, but if you want, like, the King Creole music, you got to come see the movie first, and then you can buy the record, like, of the King Creole soundtrack kind of thing.
So here is the background information to this movie. So
all right.
Elvis Presley would later say that of all the characters he's ever played and all the movies he ever acted in, this was his favorite.
Really?
That the Danny character was his favorite and King Creole was his favorite movie.
I'm a little worried we're hearing all of this so soon after four movies, and there's like 28 to go. And it's like, we've already watched the best. It's Elvis's favorite. Like,
I am happy, though. Like, we keep saying, I think, on every episode, we didn't know what to expect. And I'm sort of surprised that we got a movie this good.
Okay. I hear what you mean. I've never seen this movie before, and I had only thought, I was like, oh yeah, Jailhouse Rock is like a good Elvis movie. It's like, no, this like blows that out of the water.
Yeah.
It's like miles and miles above it. This would be good without Elvis, you know? Like, it's good with Elvis. It's probably better because he can sing all the songs and stuff.
Well, speaking of that, this was originally written for James Dean.
Whoa.
The part. But then he died, of course, in 1955. And so then they staged, I guess they just had a script that just like, it's written. And so they staged an off-Broadway version of it.
Oh.
And then when Elvis, they were trying to figure out if they could recast it or whatever, and they finally were like, hey, like, let's do Elvis. And so they reworked it. And so he was originally a boxer in New York, and then it became, you know, a singer in New Orleans. So, like, it's a similar, I guess, kind of story. Or maybe not.
They really reworked. That's a whole different movie. Like, what is the same about, did he box at one nightclub and then go, like, to another nightclub and box there? No, I mean, it was probably just like a, you know, it was probably like a noir, like anything else. And now they like, we can add music, but let's also add like a colorful location and a place that the nightclubs are maybe a little more sort of like exotic. You can still do the crime there. You know, the crime stuff
crime
still
is global,
fits.
Baby.
Yeah, right. That's right.
So speaking of noir, Michael Curtiz, the director, said he shot the film in black and white for dramatic ambiance and gave the streets a film noir appearance.
Yeah, it has that.
And the other directorial flourish that he did, or the choice that he made, was to surround the relatively inexperienced Elvis with an established cast of like Walter Matthau and Vic Morrow and so on.
So it's kind of funny because at times, or maybe throughout, maybe it's part of the style, but I feel like everybody's sort of overacting to sort of match Elvis a little bit or to make him look a little better, or just that they're all on the same kind of level. But like, there are some extremely dramatic sequences, you know what I'm saying, where it's like would be parodied today, I think, but it's just the style at the time.
It's also 62 years ago.
That's what
right?
I mean. It's just the way, it's still enjoyable.
So speaking of Elvis in that role, speaking of Elvis sort of as the inexperienced, maybe not the best actor in the thing, but when Michael Curtiz hired him, he apparently told Elvis to lose 15 pounds and shave his sideburns.
Oh.
And Elvis was like, whoa, like he was taken aback, quote, taken aback.
Oh.
But he did both of them.
I'm taken aback.
Before filming began, Michael Curtiz thought that he was going to be a, quote, conceited boy.
Right.
Not a poor boy, but a conceited boy. After a few weeks of working together, he described Elvis as a lovely boy who would go on to be a wonderful actor.
Nice.
And then when Elvis died, Walter Matthau said he was an instinctive actor, quite bright, very intelligent. He was not a punk. He was very elegant, sedate, and refined and sophisticated. Wow. So these people had nothing but good things to say about Elvis the actor.
That seems to be the way it is, you know. It's everyone kind of at first is like, oh, not Elvis. And then they're like, wow, Elvis is just like everyone else. Like, he's a good actor. He can do this, that, whatever. You know, he's not just a one-trick pony.
So this is the last movie that he would make before he was drafted into the Army.
Yes.
The next movie we're doing is G.I. Blues, which I'm guessing is probably drawing on his...
Army experience.
Exactly.
Of all the singing he did at the Army.
He was actually supposed to get drafted or leave for war, leave for the Army, whatever, basically as they started shooting this, but then the studio petitioned and they were granted a 60-day extension before Elvis went away. So they basically filmed it. I think it debuted and then he left either the next day or like the next week or something like that. So it was like a very, we need X amount of time. If you take him, we are going to lose millions of dollars or whatever the production was, right?
Right.
And so we need, and then they're like, all right, fine.
Cool.
I don't know if you recognize, did you recognize the girlfriend?
Nellie?
Yeah.
No.
So she was the girlfriend in Loving You.
No way.
Yeah.
Huh, she's
back.
So
in both of those movies, Elvis is seemingly in love with an older woman, and then finally at the end realizes, oh yeah, Dolores Hart is the
So wait, the one she was the brother's wife?
No. Loving You is the one where he tours with the Texas...
Oh, I'm sorry. The other one is...
They're all the same movie.
No,
it's, okay.
It's the same movie, but it's got... It, doesn't it have, like, Loving You in the title or something? Or,
Love Me Tender?
Love Me Tender. That's the one
which
I was
originally
thinking.
Called Loving You, I think.
Something like that.
Or vice versa.
All right, we're already four movies in, and I can't get them all straight.
We haven't watched these in a while. I think we were doing, like, December and January,
but that's
right,
a good point. This movie is very different than the others as far as there's no... It's not Elvis's story as far as, like, oh, we discovered this guy who can sing. And now we're going to give him a record contract, and now he's going to be a big star, and it's not. And then he's going to forget it was all about the music, and, you know, this is different than that. He just goes and sings in a nightclub for the whole movie.
So Dolores Hart, a couple years after making this movie, would leave Hollywood to become a nun.
Whoa.
I think in 2012, I believe it was the year, but I think it was 2012, somebody made a short documentary about her that was Oscar nominated. It was titled, a quote that she said, and the name of the documentary was God is the Bigger Elvis.
Which is
a great title. Carolyn Jones, who I think plays Ronnie in this, refused to kiss Elvis while making this movie, even though they smooched several times in this movie, of course. And she said she shied away from him one time because she had the flu. And she said, I remember saying, Elvis, don't kiss me, you'll get sick. And he said, don't worry about it. He kissed me and then immediately went away to the army. So, you know, as we record this, as the coronavirus is sweeping the world.
Oh, right.
You know, Elvis is bringing the flu from Ronnie overseas.
It's transmitter.
Mm-hmm. This movie reached number 5 on the Variety box office earnings chart, so it was a pretty big hit.
Damn.
Has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
No. Wow.
I mean,
what?
It's a weighted average of 6.79, so everybody thinks it's a good movie, but it's not like a great movie. You know what I mean? Like, it's a well-made, Elvis's best movie to date, like we were saying. You know, on IMDb, it has a 7, which is the highest so far. On Letterboxd, it's a 3.4, which is the highest so far. Like, this is sort of far and away the best Elvis movie so far.
We're gonna get into problems later, and just in the sense that, like, we might not get quote-unquote better movies, but I think I'm gonna like stuff more than this down the line. Like,
what
wasn't
are you looking for in an Elvis movie?
I don't know but I don't think it's noir. Like, I don't think it's Elvis noir. Like, it's not that it's bad. It kind of reminded me of Sonny a little bit, where I was like, I don't know if Franco is exactly, like, right for this. But like, you know, I was getting those kinds of vibes, and I don't know. It just caught me off guard. Like, I mean, I guess that's good, though, you know, because it just, like, completely sideswiped my expectations. And I was like, I guess Elvis can do noir. But when they're, like, running on the pier at the end and they're bleeding and he's, like, Elvis was in and, like, stabbed several times, I'm like, this is going a little too far for an Elvis movie.
Well, that's what I like about it, because it's like, this isn't what I expected at all. You know what I mean? Like, there's strippers and there's gangs there's murder and there's muggings and there's crime.
One of the main characters is a call girl, right? And she just keeps reminding Elvis, like, don't you get it? I belong to him. Like, I'm a floozy. I'm a tramp.
And the last bit of trivia is that Paramount did a 4K remaster of this that they viewed last year.
I wish I watched that, because so far, all my Elvis movies' quality are, like, crap.
Oh, I will say, so I was so annoyed that I was trying to figure out, because I think we've talked about before that basically all the Elvis movies come in, like, these 4-packs, these 8-packs, whatever.
Right.
You just buy one and get most of them. There's a couple duplicates. Last time, we were talking about how I watched Jailhouse Rock, and I was like, this kind of looks like shit. Yeah, like this, whatever. I own it on Blu-ray. I didn't even look at the Blu-ray. There's, like, a 3 Blu-ray pack. So, whatever. I don't think it would have made me like that movie anymore, but...
No, but I was sitting there watching it going, like, I wish I had a nice copy of this movie. Or I wish the available copy of
I think it looks pretty nice.
No, it's okay. I just meant the print. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying it's shot and it's an ugly film. I'm just saying, like, the transfer. I was like, wow, this is just someone just slopped this on DVD.
Well, similarly, well, I think that's just what happens when you have, like, four movies for $6 or whatever, right? It's just like, let's just get it out there. Similarly, if you listen to the album on Spotify, there's, like, a hiss under all of it. Like, you know, you sort of remaster the, you know, I don't know. So we start off and there's people just singing, there's salesmen singing about turtles and berries and gumbo.
Made me think of Kyle.
Well, so
I was like, this is a famous food scene for sure.
This is both a foodie film and a high school slumber party film.
I couldn't believe
it. Both Hoff Bros, two of the shows on the network. Well, three of the shows on the network if you count P.S. of Hoffman.
Yeah, or four if you count Cage. This is a Cage domain in New Orleans, you know.
It checks so many boxes, but we have people singing about food in the opening, and then we take a credit scene and we go right into Crawfish, where he is singing alongside this woman named Kitty White, who's an LA-based jazz singer.
We never meet her in the movie, right? We just see her across the street.
It just feels like every morning they just like sing back and forth, a call and repeat.
Yeah.
Except the second time she sings it, he doesn't sing back. He's just like, yeah, it's crawfish time.
True. He's got to, I got to get to work.
You mentioned in the plot summary that he works at a club. He sweeps up at this club, right? Mm-hmm. The one that's owned by Maxie.
Yeah.
But we don't meet Maxie from the beginning, right?
No, it takes a while.
We meet Ronnie and a couple of his thugs or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I hear you can sing or whatever. He kind of gets bullied into singing his high school anthem.
And that's when it really sinks in that he's a high school kid. I mean, they're talking about graduation and stuff in, like, the first scene with his sister. And they're like, you know, Daddy always wanted you to graduate high school. I was like, high school? I was like, not college? I was like, not a college education? This is crazy.
Well, what I do love, you know, you mentioned Cage a little bit ago. There are so few movies where Cage was a family man and, like, he had, like, a sister. Like, here, Elvis with a sister is a nice touch.
Oh,
like,
Elvis all the time. I mean, he married his brother's wife. Like, he's always a family boy, like, it seems.
Very, very true. Not in real life.
No.
In Love Me Tender.
Love Me Tender. Where the ghost of Elvis appears at the end.
He then also, after he sings Steadfast, Loyal, and True, he defends Ronnie's honor. He tries to anyway. So Carolyn Jones, who played Ronnie, was Oscar nominated for the movie called The Bachelor Party. Not Bachelor Party with...
No, not Hanks.
Hanks, but in 1957's The Bachelor Party.
Huh. She's good.
What I loved seeing here is that very early on, like, you know, we're like 10 minutes into the movie, and he breaks two bottles. Like, he's ready to cut a guy.
Oh, I know. Double fist and broken bottles. I was like, this kid's got a temper.
And he says, now you know what I do for an encore. I was like,
shit. There's a couple good lines. That's like a very famous line, I feel. And I was like, did that originate in this movie?
Maybe.
Because that's a great line.
So this is based on a 1952 best-selling novel. So I don't know if that was original to the screenplay, or I don't know if that was original to the novel, or where it came from. But, like, there's a couple lines in here that I'm like, well, those are some good burns.
There's another one where someone's like, yeah, he's a good boy. He fights real dirty. I was like, that's a great line.
Later, Elvis is talking about, like, you know, Ronnie says, you know, maybe there can be an accident, we can meet up or something. And he says, maybe tell me where that accident will happen and I'll be there. It's like, what? it's like city slicking talk. I love it.
I know. Were they a relocated family or something when the mom disappeared? Did they say anything about that in this movie?
I don't understand the history, because there was the Shore House or whatever.
Yeah, it seems like they used to be kind of wealthy, because he takes that girl, Nellie, to see their old house.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's when things were good, and, like, we had plenty, good and plenty. Just like the food. Just mm-hmm. like the... mm-hmm. And he's like, and now they're not good and plenty. They're bad and...
Few,
yeah.
And far between.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes from the club to the school. He gets called to the principal's office, and Mrs. Pearson,
whoa.
Mrs. Parks,
hold
Mrs.
on a second. He pulls up to the school.
Oh, right, yeah, I forgot about this.
and the friends and the people at school are like, hey, what you got with you? Like, some kind of hooker or something?
And he makes out with her in front of everybody, and then just lights into a guy.
Dude,
just
some guy's like, way to go, Elvis, and the guy's like, shut up, you, and he punches him right in the face.
And we later find out that's Shark's brother, Vic Morrow's brother, later after Vic Morrow tries to mug Elvis, almost beats him up. He's just like,
it's just
you know, you're right. My kid brother does need to learn some manners.
Like, I know we got to talk about the principal and stuff, but that is an amazing scene when Vic Morrow's like, hey, you're the guy who beat up my brother. I'm going to kick your ass. And Elvis, like, takes him out immediately, and he's like, I'm sorry. And then he's like, you want to hang with us? Be part of I'm like, what the hell is going on here? It's amazing.
I was thinking, and this is not at all about Elvis, and I don't know why I thought of this other than I've been watching a lot of basketball lately, but there's a new player on the perfectly tied in. New Orleans Pelicans has a rookie named Zion Williamson, who was on Duke last year, who was tearing up NCAA, whatever. He was great, and he's this huge guy. He's like the second heaviest guy in the league, but he's so quick. And the thing that people talk about is his explosive first step. And I feel like watching Elvis, like I'm scouting Elvis.
Nice.
And it feels like Elvis, like, you know, he's looking at Vic Morrow, and there's two guys to his right. And it feels like before anybody can react, Elvis has, like, taken a step and, like, has him against the wall. He's like, you can
oh, yeah.
fight me, but I'm going to break his neck against the wall. They're
he's
like,
so fast.
All right. That's so just like, fast. It's the furiousness.
Yes.
The
ooh,
ferocity.
Nice. He's furious.
With which
yes.
he does this. I'm just like, it's like, you can't stop him.
No. You want him on your side. Don't be an enemy of this kid.
So he's in the principal's office with the teacher and the principal.
And he's not going to graduate because he decked that kid.
And he calls the teacher honey?
And she's
like, hold
never,
on here, honey. She's
never.
Like, I've been 30 years and no one's ever called me honey. And she's like, because of that, basically, you're not graduating.
Yeah.
And then he tells the principal, he's like, I'm not a hoodlum. Because she's like,
oh, wait,
he's trouble. You know, he's just a bad boy. He's a poor boy, whatever.
Poor boy.
And she leaves and he says, I'm not a hoodlum, but I am a hustler.
Yeah, because the principal's like, I don't want to see you growing up to be a hoodlum or a hustler. And he goes into this story about his son who was a hoodlum and ended up dying, I think. I can't remember exactly. And I was like, okay, this is where we're getting into, like, this is huge at the time with juvenile delinquency. I was like, this is great. Like, it's going to be Elvis the juvenile delinquent, like, out in the streets for a while, like, getting into trouble, being, you know, a bad kid. And that kind of is what goes on for, like, a while. Like, he immediately leaves school and the Vic Morrow gang tries to jump him.
This reminds me, this scene in the principal's office reminds me of Loving You. Remember where Glenda, the manager, takes on City Hall? She's just like, hey, I just took on City Hall. Like, it feels like Elvis is taking on City Hall, where he's trying to, like, vouch for his
yeah.
you know, to the
yeah, because he comes back, he's like, look at here, principal. He's like, my daddy don't work. I have, like, four jobs. You know, before school, I was dealing with all this shit. He's like, get off my back, man. And the principal's like, you're right, you're right.
Like, but also, like, Elvis doesn't want to graduate. He doesn't care. He just wants to make money, because he is, at his core, a family man. He wants to make sure that his dad and his sister are okay. Right. I think he feels a little hemmed in by the fact that his dad just won't work.
Well, it becomes like this generation gap kind of understanding thing where his dad's like, you got to learn a trade. You got to learn a trade and go to school and get a graduate degree, because he's a pharmaceutical guy. He's a pharmacist, you know? He doesn't understand that, like, Elvis can make money singing music and that he's, like, talented and has this great, like, ability and stuff. And it's just like the sign of the times kind of thing, where it's like
sign O the times.
It's a big sign in lights that
are we gonna make this
says
into a Prince
Dirk
podcast?
Diggler. And so, like, I think it's kind of an interesting commentary the movie's trying to make, where it's like all these new sort of, like, ideas about what's a profession are sort of popping up in America now, where it's like, oh, where you used to be sort of like a jazz bow, roustabout, whatever, like, now you could actually make money being, like, a jazz star or musician or something.
Roustabout is a future one of his movies, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
All right.
And jazz bow is what is from the Superman 3 novelization.
Ooh.
It's what Richard Pryor called somebody.
I'm on fire, man. What would Richard Pryor say? So I think what's interesting about character development in this movie is that his dad is routinely characterized as a man who thinks he knows best.
Right.
That they show him every time at the pharmacy, where he's just like,
oh, right.
Hey, like, I appreciate it, but, like, you're doing this wrong. Like, cut it in here. And the guy's like, why won't you understand that I'm your boss? Shut up and mop.
Yeah.
And it seems like through the entire movie, like, it's effective in that, like, his dad might know best, but he also doesn't know his place. Not in a bad way, but, like, he wants the best for his son. He wants to basically help his boss, but he also needs to realize that he's, like, literally his first day on the job. Maybe don't tell your boss that he's doing things wrong.
Yeah.
Or when your son has, like, a legitimate, upstanding business offer to make good money.
Do you ever realize that they both sort of had shit bosses? Like, Elvis eventually has to deal with Walter Matthau's character, but his dad's boss, right? So, like, he goes in there, and Elvis's dad is, like, 40 years of experience. The guy won't hire him, and then that guy's boss comes in, and he's like, why won't you hire him? And he's like, because he's too old. And the guy's like, the last four young people you hired sucked. Hire this man. And so the guy's, like, begrudgingly hires Elvis's dad, and he, like, should be that dude's boss. You know what I'm saying? Like, Elvis's dad should be running the show. So it's like everybody's stuck on these places in the ladder that they, you know, don't deserve to be, really.
Yeah. We have the scene that you mentioned before, that you acted out before beautifully, where Vic Morrow and his gang try to take Elvis down, but Elvis quickly gets the upper hand and gets an invite to the gang, which is just amazing.
Oh my
like,
God.
I've never seen that. Like,
never.
If you can't beat them, join them, or ask them to join you, I guess?
Or, yeah, that was amazing. It kind of reminded me of, I mean, this is a crazy, I'm going to pull this, but you remember in Rocky V, Rocky gets, his son is beat up like half the movie, and then he finally stands up for himself. Remember, he's like, go for it. You want my coat and stuff? He's like, go for it. And he beats the hell out of the bullies, and then, like, two scenes later, they're all hanging out together, like, watching television on Christmas. It's like that syndrome, whatever you call that.
Well, it's like the Office Space quote, speaking of Superman 3, it's like the first day of prison, you either become someone's bitch or kick someone's ass, right? Like,
just
exert your dominance. They're like, ah, he's all right. Like, I guess if you show people you're crazy, then you, like, it's weird that you become friends. Like, I can see them not hating you, but, like, becoming friends.
Wanting
is, like,
to join up.
Elvis then his dad tries to, like, talk him into the school. He's like, I'm not going back to school. And then he hates his dad for basically never throwing his... He's like, I've turned too many cheeks. I've got no more cheeks to turn. And he talks about how, like, his dad got punched in the face or something. Like, just took it.
Oh, yeah. When I was a little kid, I saw Daddy get punched in the face. And that's why he's got such a hot temper. He's like, Daddy's, like, meek and this, and I will never be like that.
It feels like most of Elvis's personality and character in this movie is defined by things he has seen his dad take.
Yeah.
Like, he walks into the pharmacy twice in this movie, and both times his dad is getting reamed out. Just like... He's got the worst timing, or this is happening 100% of the time, in which case, why are you still, like, why has he not been fired, or why has he not quit? I don't know.
It was funny when he went in the first time, and he's like, to his dad's boss, he's like, look, last time I was here, you gave me the wrong medicine, I almost died. He's like, you should listen to this man, he knows what he's talking about. It's like, how do you know Elvis? And then the pharmacist is like, yeah, okay.
And I like that Elvis is about to become, like, I guess he's not yet, but he's about to become, like, the most famous man in New Orleans, and this guy does not know that he's this new hire's son, right?
Just right, like, that they're not related at all.
Yeah, it's just like, hey, yeah, I think this guy's really good. You should give him a raise.
It's also incredible to remind yourself the whole time that he's 19 in this movie, and that he's just a teenager, and his life is so crazy like this.
No. So his dad refuses to let him get work because he has the legitimate job offer, and he says no, and so then he goes back to Vic Morrow. He's like, hey, you said I can make money, right? He's like, yeah, come with me. So then, this is my favorite thing, I think, in any Elvis movie
amazing.
Ever. He pulls a Roman in Furious
yep.
7,
yep.
where he is the distraction, and he goes into the Five and Dime.
I thought of Fast and Furious so hard.
And he sings Lover Doll. As he's singing, and the entire store is just like, hey, impromptu musical performance.
Yeah, this is amazing. Look
all
at
of Vic Morrow's gang steal a bunch of stuff. One guy just walks
out with a bicycle.
And so then he sits down at the counter, and Nellie, Dolores Hart, you know, his former girlfriend from two movies ago, is like, hey, so you were in on that, huh? And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, my God. And she's like, I like that you were in on that, though.
Which is the crazy... So, okay, so the entire movie, I don't understand, and I feel like this is just the common thread in all the Elvis movies, both movies specifically, I don't know why he doesn't realize that Dolores Hart is perfect, and he always wants to get in with an older woman who's wrong for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the way
like,
things
it, are literally in this movie,
young...
Ronnie has to die for him to be like, all right, yeah, she's pretty good. Like, Nellie's pretty good.
I don't know. I think part of it is things have always sort of been like that, where it's like, for men and women in movies more often, it's like, well, the older experienced person is the more interesting, you know, maybe that's the more dangerous, that's more alluring. Someone my own age, like, come on, like, there's so many people my own age, but eventually, like, yeah, you know, he comes around. Their first date is a doozy, holy shit.
We will get there. They go out to the alleyway to divvy up the funds, and there's this guy whose literal name is Dummy.
Oh,
so, like, on High School Slumber Party, the last few episodes, Brian has implemented new categories, new awards. One of them is, like, which high schooler does not look like a high schooler?
Elvis.
But one is just, like, if they remade this today, what would be changed? Like, what's maybe problematic? The Long Duck Dong Award. A character who can't speak named Dummy is not exactly great, but...
Nope.
What is really good storytelling, I guess, is that Elvis does him a kindness because Shark, Vic Morrow, is just like, oh, he can't talk. He's a dummy.
Yeah, what's he need money for?
Here's $5. Like, we're the three of us are going to split in the other 90 or whatever, right? And Elvis is like, no, give me five. Here's an equal share. And that one act of kindness, I guess after a life of being bullied, Dummy then literally saves Elvis's life and kills Max at the end. I mean, not intentionally.
No,
but like,
yeah, but ends up saving his life at the end. But what's even crazier is that after Elvis leaves, he's like, you let me know if they mess with you anymore, right, Dummy? And he's like, yeah, okay. And then Vic Morrow, like, doesn't take the money back, like, abides by Elvis's justice and stuff.
I think he's afraid
like,
of Elvis.
He is scared, well, at least for now, right? Until, like, he starts working
Until
for Maxie.
Until Maxie's supporting him, yeah.
Yeah, and he's got a great arc in this movie, Shark.
So then they all go to the club, and this is where we first meet Walter Matthau.
I just gotta say, I was like, who's this not Walter Matthau actor they got? Because I had never seen him this young in a film before.
What is he? What would I? I know he's
Grumpy,
a Grumpy
Old
Men.
Yeah,
but
I knew him.
But that was like later in his life.
Bad
like, that's
News
30
Bears.
Years after this. Like,
that, I mean,
where was he famous in the 50s, or was he just like a regular, like a working actor?
I I think he was mostly like a regular working actor, because I didn't really become aware of him until like Taking of the Phelim and Bad News Bears. So like his 70s, late 70s work is where I really kind of latched on to him.
But this is still 20 years before that.
I know. Well, that's the thing. I didn't know he was around back then. So the first scene where he's introduced, I'm like, they got the prototype of Walter Matthau. But no, it turns out to be him.
Actual Walter Matthau.
And he's great in
this. It's crazy. And Ronnie says something like, you know, she greets Elvis or whatever. And he's like, how do you know him? And how do you know my
Dude,
girl?
He is insane,
and
right?
And Elvis is like, you know, for as streetwise as he is, like, he doesn't get the hierarchy. Like, he's not afraid of, I guess that's also the thing, like, he's not afraid of Maxie.
Right.
And then she, like, has to, like, well, you know, I saw him sing once, I told him he has a nice voice, like, that's it. And he's like, oh, I hear you can sing. Sing for us, monkey, like, dance for us. And that's when he sings Trouble. And then that's when Maxie's like, hey, work for me. And he's like, no.
Well, it's crazy, because he sings Trouble, like, to Maxie. He's like, I'm trouble, like, you don't want to fuck with me, you know, like, those are kind of like what the lyrics are implying, right? It's like, you know, don't make me mad kind of thing. And then he gets off stage and Maxie's like, yeah, you know what, kiddo, like, you can't sing, sorry about that, just checking, just making sure. Like, crazy. I was like, this guy is a psycho.
You might be banging my girl, but, like, you know, she's not lying about
at least
this,
yeah, at least. At least this one thing.
At least I can make a buck off.
Oh, yeah. He flat out is like, I'm not going to work for you. And then isn't that when King Creole's owner, like, comes right up and he's like, come work for me. Like, I got nothing to do with this guy.
My next note is about the first date he has with Nelly.
Oh, my goodness.
Where
okay.
he picks her up after the Five and Dime closes, and then he just straight up brings her to a hotel.
Dude, have you ever heard of this? Where it's like, we're going to go to a party at a hotel. You get there, and it's an empty room.
And she's just like, oh, this isn't for me. But then, like, the rest of the movie, she's, like, racked with guilt. She's like, I almost did it. It's like, but you didn't.
Right.
But I guess
but then she's
different...
like, I wish I was that kind of person. I mean, she's supposed to be the polar opposite of the other woman in Elvis's life and everything like that. So it goes a little too far, maybe, with her, but it's funny. That's the problem. Like, it just kind of ends up being funny.
Like, she confesses to him. I don't think it's funny, because I think it's like, because I feel like she's
no, it's not supposed to be funny.
Sweet and innocent, and she, like, she just feels like she is trapped in this small town, even though it's New Orleans, but it feels like a small town, sort of. And she wants a new life, and she doesn't, you know, nobody in her life is exciting, and we don't know anything really about her, mm-hmm. but obviously she wants him because, like, this guy comes in, robs her store, and she's like, ooh, yeah, this guy.
But she's also like, I don't know why I like you so much. I'm like, yes, you do, because he's hot as hell, because he's Elvis, because of the way he looks.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's all right. Get to know him. But once you get to know him and you find out that he's, like, a hoodlum, don't stay with him if you don't want to, just because he's good-looking. It's, like, just because he's Elvis. Because then you're just trapped. Then it parallels the relationship with the women in Maxie in the way that he treats them, you know? Like, they just hang around him for dependency at that point. And it's like, you don't want to be like that. You don't want to just be hanging around Elvis.
Then we find out that Elvis is basically like the Hulk, because they're like, hey, sing again. You just sang so good. And he's just like, that's because I was mad. They're like, well, then stay mad. It's like, okay. Charlie LeGrand, who is the owner of King Creole, is like, hey, invite me over for dinner. I'll clear up the whole thing with your dad. And he can't, but that's where he successfully picks up Elvis's sister.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that weird that, like, even the principal comes over, or the dad's like, I had a talk with the principal. You can go to night school and finish, and it's like, no, man, you just don't get it. And then the club owner comes over, and it's like, your son could make, like, a lot of money. And his dad's like, I don't care. Like, that's not work. It's like, wait a second, though. He's getting paid for doing something. That's work. Like,
yeah.
I don't understand.
Elvis mentions that he wants a pink convertible, which at this point he already had his pink Cadillac.
Nice.
Apparently the first one caught on fire or something. Because I Googled, when did Elvis buy his pink Cadillac? Cause that's like one of his, like, hallmark classic cars or whatever. And it said in 1955 he bought a second one after the fire ruined the first. So I don't I didn't look into that.
Okay.
But he already by this point had the pink Cadillac. So
nice.
Pink convertible, just drawing on real life. So then Danny Boom Boom Fisher, as he's credited, opens the night of King Creole, but first we hear Banana, and then they introduce him as the boy with the beat, Danny Fisher, singing King Creole, and people, not on board at first, then quickly love it.
Yeah, it's like an instant hit. It's like, no one's ever seen anything, and this seems to be the thing about Elvis in movies, is like, what? It's like Marty McFly at the end of the Sea Dance. It's like, where did this come from? Like, who is this guy? Like, this, like, what is happening to my ears?
Yeah.
Like, I can't, like, everything changed in that moment.
And that's when I say, put his name up in lights.
Yeah.
So then there's a second date. That's when they're on their boat. We were talking about.
Mm-hmm. A little more tame there.
She says, I told my mother about you. I told her I met $1 million boyfriend in a 5 and 10 cent store.
Mm.
Which is a great line. A
lot of good writing here.
And then Elvis says he wants to be somebody before he's a family man. He says, don't fall in love with me. She's like, I won't, just kiss me. And he kisses her on the cheek. She's like, I want more. It's like, let's pump the brakes a little bit. So then this is where I feel like the movie becomes more of the classic, the prototypical Elvis movie, because basically every 10 minutes for the last, like, 50, he's singing another song. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes sense. It fits.
No, you're
because
right,
because he's a nightclub singer, but it's like, okay, this is where he plays Young Dreams. This is where he plays New Orleans. This is where he plays Don't Ask Me Why.
It's, like, brilliant to make him a nightclub singer. Yeah. You know, it's like we talk about later, like, how well is the music integrated into the movie? Like, perfectly in this instance, you know? But it does become a bit overkill because we have to get away from the story and it becomes sort of like a boss rush at the end of this movie, right? Where it's like, oh, we got to do this and now we got to do this. And like,
nice phrase. I like that.
You know?
I think that's why I don't really like the back third as much as the first two thirds, because I feel like so much happens. Like,
yeah,
it makes
sense.
It
out.
It tracks. Like, they set things up to just like, oh, like what was originally just kind of like a kind of a romance, kind of a noir, like him trying to get by, suddenly then Shark and his guys are like, hey, we'll beat up your dad's boss and show him what's what.
Mm-hmm.
But then his dad is wearing the coat and jacket because it's, or the hat and jacket or whatever, because
yeah,
it's raining. And so then Shark beats him up anyway, later admits, I knew it was your dad all along. But then, like, that sets him into the hospital,
yeah.
And then that's when he needs this expensive surgery, and then that's when one of Maxie's guys is like, don't worry, Maxie's got it,
no,
and then Elvis falls under Maxie's thumb, and Maxie's like, hey, you're going to work for me, I just pay for your dad's surgery, by the way, if you don't work for me, I'm going to tell him that you mugged him, and then, oh, by the way, after you sign the contract, I'm going to tell him anyway just because I'm an asshole and I have you under my thumb.
Like, that needs to be doled out over the course of the second act and not just sort of, like, shoved in towards the end of the movie like that. Because it is sort of, like, head-spinning. I was like, wait, like, oh, slow down. Come on.
Because I feel like movies, you can tell that movies either have a slow part or, like, craziness is by following along. And I wasn't really following along throughout the entire movie, but, like, I open up the wiki plot summary and it's just, like, the last, like, three paragraphs is like, there's so much that happens, and it's like, and then this person dies, it's like, wait, what is going on? Like, it just feels of a good, like a really good pace. And maybe if this movie, again, Elvis's longest ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if it was another 45 minutes, I feel like this would all feel more natural.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like maybe because the first two-thirds had taken its time to great effect, they're like, well, we can't have a three-hour movie, but I kind of would have liked a three-hour movie.
Yeah, it almost deserves that, or dare I say, you know, we got to get the version without the music, right? Like the original cut with James Dean in New York, you know what I'm saying?
I guess we do have like 15 or 20 minutes of just actual music.
Yeah, like that kind of takes up space, and you know, it's good, I'm glad it's in this version.
Although, the question would be, if it's the original version, do we have 15 minutes of just boxing? We might.
Oh, good call. But I don't know. It's hard because like something you could do with that is sort of like you could do storytelling through a boxing match. You can't really do that. Well, I guess you can't. I don't know. I just don't get the sense that they're telling any story or I'm getting any new information through Elvis after the one song he sings about like being trouble. The rest of the music doesn't really
like,
service the scene
a couple
for any reason.
Toward the end, like as long as I have you or whatever, as long as I have you, like that.
Yeah, that's when I do like it though. Like that's what I like most
but
about.
Basically,
the
music. Yeah, songs like 6 through 10 or whatever, just like he's just singing songs to sell records, guy.
Yeah,
which isn't bad, but it's just like you had done such a good job of like fitting these in naturally and having them to some extent progress.
Like
the
robbery was perfect,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Like he gets so much information in that scene. It's great.
So then Maxie sends Shark to jump Elvis, maybe kill Elvis or scare Elvis, I don't know. And Elvis does a great thing where, like, he takes the one goon out, and then Maxie's like, or not Maxie, Shark is like, you got him, and Elvis is like, yeah. And then he comes
right,
around the corner,
right.
And then Elvis squares up with him, Shark cuts his arm, and then Elvis jams Shark's knife into Shark's heart,
yep,
killing him.
Yeah, that's brutal. I've
and
never seen
never
that.
And he never faces punishment.
Never going to see that again in an Elvis movie. Never thought I'd ever see that in an Elvis movie.
Murder
but
Elvis.
That is a great gag. He's so street smart that when he kills the one thug, he pretends to be that thug that had just killed him.
I don't think he kills the first one. He maybe
or
knocked
him out
yeah.
or whatever, but I'm just assuming they're all going to bleed out in the street.
Yeah.
Like, no one's
it's
coming
amazing.
To them.
So then this is where, like, shit is breaking bad, and then Ronnie basically rescues him and brings him to her secret bayou home. Like
oh, yeah.
Out on the water.
So this is, like, classic film noir kind of shit, where, like, the hero's bleeding out, and they're just at the hideout.
Yeah.
But it's, like, on the one pier. It's, like, it's so unhidden.
Well, you can, I guess the upside is that you can see somebody coming from literally a mile away,
but
right?
Where do you go? She doesn't have
you
a
can't.
Boat.
they're just like on the pier, like, please don't shoot me. They're like, they're relying on Dummy.
Yeah.
I wrote down this point, like, I still don't understand why he doesn't love Nelly this much. Like, he's so into Ronnie. Well, and she's just proven to be, she's got a great set of legs. As you know, she won Best Legs in Maine.
That scene.
Which is a very awkward scene. Like, she pulls her skirt up, like, above the knee. I'm like, ooh, this is racy for 1958.
It is.
But it's just like, she's attractive and she's an older, I guess, experienced woman, but it just feels like, you know, and I guess maybe we, because you figure he's going to wind up with Nelly, but like, it just seems like Nelly is the one, and yet Ronnie is just, he's so smitten with her.
You know what's really weird, too, is there's that one moment where Elvis goes to see Ronnie and Maxie's asleep, and she's like, basically, like, you get to fuck me. And then if you do that, like, you work for Maxie, and, like, you could do that anytime you want. And
but if,
like,
you, if have you me. Send me away too soon, he's going to think I did a bad job, and he's going to beat me up.
And he doesn't do it, and you'd be
so, like,
we
don't
right.
have to have sex, but, like, I need to stay here for a while.
Yeah, it's bizarre, too, but it's also, like...
Oh, and also, by the way, you're going to owe Maxie money for, like, whatever time we spend.
It's so weird, because you know he wants her, like, he kissed her, they've been making out or whatever, and stuff like that, so I would be like, oh, wait, that's the deal sealer right there for Elvis. Like, this is the end for him. And no, he's like, I don't want anything to do with you like that. He's like, I don't think of you that way. He should come at me in other directions, because...
Which he does.
Yeah.
Maxie shows up and Dummy is with him for some reason, or maybe Dummy
his driver.
Followed him. Oh, he's the driver. Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then this is when he tries to shoot at Elvis, hits and kills Ronnie.
Yeah.
Which I guess, you know, he'd be upset by, but also just like, he's just, she's expendable or whatever. Dummy tackles him into the water, and then the gun goes off again.
There's a real Birds of Prey vibe going on here at the end on the pier shootout,
yeah.
Black Mask and
yeah,
everything
yeah,
like
yeah.
that. Because there's that one moment when Elvis,
wait,
like...
Wait, so Maxie is...
Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
But I love the moment when he's shooting at Elvis, and Elvis, like, ducks behind the pier pole, and you see, like, the little, like, bullet shot go off. I was like, ooh. Like, Elvis must have got shot in the face.
This is good shootsman, good marksmanship. And then after that all goes down, he just goes back to the club. Nelly, you're the one for me. I'm going to sing this love song to you. Outside, it says return engagement, indefinite stay. It's just like, hey, he's here for good.
Yep.
I said, it feels like a whole lot. Like, in both this movie and Loving You, he could have solved so much trouble just by being like, oh, Nelly, you're my girl. I'm not going to mess with anything else. Like, these two movies would have had zero conflict if he's just like,
so,
you're the one for me.
What's even crazier now is, why is he singing at the King Creole now that Maxie's dead? Why doesn't he just take that guy's restaurant and have his own place? And now he's like...
He's 19. I mean, he's...
Thanks. Thank you. You had to remind me. I said it earlier and I totally forgot. It's like, you totally forget that this is all surrounding a 19-year-old kid. And they're like, kill that kid. Kill that boy, that very young man. Get him.
Yeah. At the very end, his dad finally shows up to hear him sing. Aww. And he looks very into it. And it's like a happy ending all over the place.
That reminded me of something, too. Maybe it was like a Lost moment or something like that, I think. I feel where, like, maybe Jack showed up at, like, his son's thing. Was that when he first talked to Dogen or something? Where it was, like, he was estranged from his son, and he showed up in the back, and he saw him, and it was like, that was the moment.
It's also a very... that's not exactly, because they have a good relationship, but in Logan Lucky, right, where Channing shows up for his daughter...
That might even be it. That might even be what I was... Yes.
And I think that's the movie, right? That's basically...
That's wild.
It's good, though. It's a good one. So here are the songs. We need to figure out what the best song in the movie is. So we have got Crawfish to open the movie. We've got Steadfast, Loyal, and True, which he sings under duress at the club.
Which is his high school alma mater. Like, it's not really a song, quote-unquote. It's him singing by himself, yeah. Like, for 20 seconds.
Yeah, a lot of these songs... I mean, all the Elvis songs are basically 2 minutes or under. This is, like, a minute 10. Like, this is the shortest
yeah.
one. Lover Doll, which is the distraction of the Five and Dime. Trouble, which is what he proves to Maxie that he and Ronnie aren't lying. Dixieland, he's on stage. Young Dreams, I think he's on stage. New Orleans, he's on stage. Hard-Headed Woman, he's on stage. Or maybe, I don't even know if we hear the whole Hard-Headed Woman. I think
no, we don't. We come in at the end of that.
The middle of that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Then he follows that up with King Creole. Then Don't Ask Me Why on stage. And then As Long As I Have You at the very end. So which of those do you think... What's your favorite? What's the best song in this movie?
I don't know if you remember this, but like coming into this whole Elvis... deal, like King Creole is like my favorite Elvis song right now.
Ooh.
So like I have to go with that. It may not be the best song in the movie, but I mean, it's what am I supposed to do? It's like
yeah.
it came on and I started going crazy.
I love the use of Lover Doll. Like that's my favorite
yes,
use of the
very,
song in the
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, that's a great scene.
Trouble's a great song. I think As Long As I Have You is a great song. So we can say I'll go King Creole. I mean, it's the titular song, it's important. But here's the question: best Elvis song so far, is it better than Lonesome Cowboy?
Oh, dude. I'm such a lonesome cowboy.
I think that's great.
That is not really my jam ordinarily, you know, but it just personifies Elvis so well. Like, I don't know that, even if I like King Creole more, I think that's a better song. Is that weird? Does that make sense? Yeah.
But like, my favorite movies are not the best movies I've ever seen, right? So on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is perfectly natural. How natural do the songs that Elvis sings fit into the movie? Like, so far we had a 6 in Love Me Tender. We had an 8 in Loving You, because he was a singer on the road. And then we had a 5 in Jailhouse Rock, because why is he singing that many times in a prison? Close to it. Like, I don't know if it's going to feel more like closer to 10, but like a 9?
I was thinking, because like, you know what really helps is that one time we come in at the end of a song. Like, that's a really cool trick that the director did to be like, oh yeah, it's so natural and everything. I think there's just one or two moments that, like, not that they don't work, they're just like, that keeps it from being a 10, I guess. I don't know. Maybe because...
I think there's too many. If there are a couple fewer, it's like, yeah, we understand that he's an established singer. We don't need to see him sing every night at the club.
That's the thing. The way they worked it into the rest of the movie, like, prove yourself, steal this stuff, serenade her. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, they did it so well offstage in the movie, too. If they had found maybe one or two other ways to do that offstage, then it would have been a 10 for sure. But damn if it's not, like, so close.
That's so far for sure, though.
Yeah.
If you remember, every episode we guess what the next movie's about. So for this movie, you said Elvis and Enola, which you were right.
Nice.
Kara said she thought there was going to be an oversized crawfish, which there is not, but there's a song crawfish. And then I said he wrestles an alligator, which did not happen, unfortunately.
I think I have a new default what I want my next Elvis movie to be that I'm just going to keep using until it happens.
Which is?
Elvis gets amnesia.
So you think G.I. Blues is...
Shit, that's next thing. Yeah. No, he can't get in. Unless he gets amnesia and he ends up in the army and he's like, how'd I get here? No, G.I. Blues, I think, is going to be about, you know, not only does he just go to the army, but I think there might be like a Don Draper situation going on. Ooh. Where like he takes the dog tags of a fallen friend and like continues on in his name kind of thing.
I'm going to say... he goes to the army.
Did I just spoil, like, all of Mad Men, by the way?
No, that's really early on. Okay, Dick Whitman stuff. Like, because I've only seen the first two seasons. And, like, that's it in season two,
first,
I think.
First season or something.
Because I always thought that was, like, the big reveal, but it's, like, it's not. But also, yeah. Also, it doesn't really change. Like, just, you just know that he's kind of a scumbag, but you kind of get that he's a scumbag from the beginning anyway.
Right.
He's singing... I just see, like, a thing where he's singing love songs via letter... to a girl back home.
That's funny. I know you don't really watch SNL, but they do a pretty funny skit where, like, there are war letters corresponding back and forth, and they're just, like, increasingly ludicrous. But, like, I like the idea of, like, singing through... song through letter,
because he's just like, you know, it starts, it's kind of like what you did on the recent Cruise Club episode where Valkyrie, where he's like, he's speaking German, it becomes English. It's like he's just writing a letter and it becomes a song.
Dude, what if this turns out to be his Full Metal Jacket and it's just like the, like, most honest, disgusting depiction of war at the time, and it just happens like the fury of the day, like starring Elvis.
Best job he ever had. So the IMDb rating for this is a 6.3, which is right in line with the first three movies. 3,000 people have seen it, which I think is just sort of right in line with the other movies. Letterboxd rating of 2.9, which ties our lowest so far. 940 people have seen it on Letterboxd, which is right in line with everything that's not Jailhouse Rock. So
there's like a small community of Elvis fans out there watching the movies and logging it on Letterboxd, so we know.
Yeah. And then the final segment on the show, Riley Keough update. Anything going on in Riley Keough's life? I know she voted. She felt the burn. She voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary.
You know how they're doing all these Instagram things where it's like, what Simpson character are you or whatever?
Oh, and
like,
which A24?
Yeah, and she went through a whole bunch of them. She's like, oh, I didn't get that.
This one, read for this one. Yeah.
Yeah. Table read. Never called back.
Yeah. I was trying to figure out in Uncut Gems. We figure she must have been, because I asked my friends.
Last night. Adam Sandler's girlfriend, right?
Yeah, but like, it feels like she's too famous for that. Like, it feels like
maybe that's why they didn't go with her.
Like there's something honest.
Because they probably looked
raw
at her because of the girlfriend experience, where it's like, it's sort of a very similar kind of...
Because she's too young for the Dina Menzel role, right?
So yeah, like, that's what I was going to bring up. She's got a movie coming out soon that sounds amazing. Yeah.
Where she's not the stripper who went viral, but she's like another whatever. She's another girl in the club with her, so yeah.
Right.
Oh, I saw The Lodge.
Oh!
Which she's in.
And?
Mm.
Oh, well.
So it's by the directing team, the man and the woman, who made Goodnight Mommy.
Okay.
Did you see Goodnight Mommy?
No, but I'm aware of it.
So
I know about it.
David Ehrlich had a really good review on Letterboxd. He said, Goodnight Mommy had logic issues. The Lodge is a logic issue.
And
Riley Keough was great, as she always is. It feels so much like an Ari Aster knockoff, ripoff, because it feels like it wants to be both Hereditary and Midsommar all in one movie.
Oh, no.
And
it's too much.
Kind of figured out what a twist was. I don't know if it's the twist, but like a big twist was. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, it ends in a way. And like, it just, it lost me part of the way through. And it just never recaptured me.
Right.
But, you know, if you want to see her in a movie, that's great. Go see The Lodge.
Yeah.
I don't love the movie, but actually, I found out. So I looked at Riley Keough's Instagram for the A24 thing because I think Ashley Benson. So this is like a weird domino event, but I was looking at Vanessa Hudgens' Instagram story.
Okay.
And obviously, she was in Spring Breakers with Ashley Benson.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at Ashley Benson's Instagram story, and she did the thing, and she got American Honey, and she tagged Riley Keough.
Oh.
And so then Riley Keough did three or four, and she's like, read for this one, read for this
and
one.
And one was Spring Breakers.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Any other thoughts about King Creole?
This is a very, very good one. I mean, I'm just a little nervous about the future, but I'm sure it'll be fine. You know, I mean, it's the court of public opinion. Like, it's a great movie. No, you know, it's a great Elvis movie. It's a great Elvis movie. I'll just say, like, if someone's going to sit down, if you really just... Okay, I think there's going to be categories. There's going to be Elvis movies that only Elvis can be in, and then Elvis movies that you could replace Elvis with a good actor, and it'll still be a very good movie. And this is one of those. This is probably the first and maybe the only one. We'll see. But this seems like, yeah, like, Elvis is great in it, but, like, yeah, I understand. You could put... They should remake this today. Like, that's how I feel about it. Like, remake this, have it take place as a period piece. You know what I'm saying? I don't know who you can get in there these days. Maybe Spider-Man. Tom Holland could play the role or something like that. I don't know.
Star of the new animated film Onward.
That's right.
With Chris Pratt.
Star-Lord. Yeah, I think this is a really good movie. People should check it out.
Yeah. For all things Viva Pod Vegas, all four episodes so far, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, king, I think, at cageclub.me,
okay.
Or just mailbag at cageclub.me. Check out our new Cage Club episode, which will be out before this, of Color Out of Space.
Nice.
Check out Mike and my weekly alternating podcast, Cruise Club and Hanks for the Memories. Check out the aforementioned Foodie Films and High School Summer Party, all 26 shows, cageclub.me/shows. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And we'll see you next time right here on Viva Pod Vegas. So thank you very much.
There's a man in New Orleans who plays a rock and roll. He's a guitar man with a great big soul. He lays down a beat like a ton of cola. He goes by the name of King Creole. You know he's gone, 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 jumping like catfish on a pole.